I've been so self-obsessed, you know what I mean? I've been like, my mind is like going. My mind has been like spinning, like for like the last 3 hours-ish. You know, how this Steps Come Alive thing came about was I was on a young people service committee in Orange County, and my mom, who had 27 years sober at the time when I got sober, and the young people in Orange County, they didn't get along with mainstream Alcoholics Anonymous. We would go to meetings, and the old timers would run us out of their meeting and sit, you know what I mean? We weren't welcomed at their meeting. We couldn't pass out our sheets. You know, we'd hear things like, we spilled more than you drank, you know what I mean? And if you still have a watch, you're not welcome here, you know, things like that. And so, you know, the young people had thrown a conference and they owed the hotel $15,000, and the old timers paid that debt back. And so it was some controversy in our local area. And I became the events chair of a committee. And I was like, how can we bridge the gap between the old timers and Alcoholics Anonymous and the young people? Right? How can we make this right? And so I created this event called Steps Come Alive, and I was going to have my mom come and present, talk for 3 hours on the steps. And we went to all the meetings, and my mom's name was on the flyers, so the old timers like, oh yeah, great, yeah, you could come here, you know, with your flyers. And so we had the event, and there was 450 people, right, all in Laguna Beach there to hear my mom speak. And then we had a barbecue, and then the young people's speaker, and then the dance. You guys were gone by then. You know, you guys weren't dancing, but you guys were there. And my mom did the Steps Come Alive for 7 years in Laguna Beach. And when my mom passed away, that committee asked me to step in and fill in for my mom's Steps Come Alive. And so I've done it for a couple years, right? And I kind of just followed suit with what she did. I was like, I feel honored, but... You know, and then I was at the Southern California Convention, and they asked me to do it, and then Billy asked me to do it, and so here I am, right? And usually it's like 3 hours long, and I just show up, and I don't know what I'm really doing, and I just found out it's been an hour, and I don't know, however long, so here we go, right? Right? You just let go, don't you? You just let go of control and show up, you know what I mean? And the funny thing is I'm praying, right? I'm like, oh my God, God, what do we want me to do? Okay, God, 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 please, please, God, 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 help me, help me. I think I've done about 55 prayers, you know, before coming from where I'm sleeping. And I hear an intuitive thought that said, I'm with you. You've already been taken care of. Just walk through and be of service. And I'm so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous, right, has taught me, the 12-step process has taught me about this intuition, right? That I have a direct channel between me and God. And I've had it my whole life. I've had it since I was a little kid, right? I didn't know that I had alcoholism. I didn't know that I had the spiritual malady that we talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that I was separated from my peers, right? Like, I didn't know what was wrong with me as a little kid. But I've always had that internal voice that said, make a right-hand turn. And I didn't trust that right-hand turn, that little voice inside. And I always made a left-hand turn. And Alcoholics Anonymous has directed me inward, right? It's directed me inward. And in the action, when I let go, when I walk through the action, right, I can start to see God working in my life. And I walk into the room, and I'm met with such kindness and such love, right? And one more time, I feel that I'm welcomed and I'm loved and I'm safe. Right, Alcoholics Anonymous has been a safe place for me. When I come and I sit with you, it's a safe place. And you guys have shown me that safe place. You know, and I'm talking at 7, so I have to tell you a bunch of stories that I usually don't talk about, right? And here's the thing is my spiritual malady is really simple. Like, I remember, you know, my mom's a blackout drinker, which means I'll never know who my dad is. I mean, for all I know, my dad could be the cable guy. You know what I mean? Like, my mom even knows she was pregnant till she was in labor. Real story. You know, my mom graduated San Diego State with a 3.8 grade point average. She didn't even know. She had to go make amends to San Diego State when she got sober. And when she went and made amends, she learned that she had a master's degree in journalism. No idea. Right? Mom gave birth to me in her apartment and came out of a blackout, and the paramedic was holding me in her apartment. And the paramedic's like, you need to name him. My mom's name is Patty, so she named me Patrick so she wouldn't forget my name. You know what I mean? And right? And so this is what came into the world. You know, my mom's father was an alcoholic. He threw her through a plate glass window. She took the abuse of his alcoholism. You know, my mom got sober when I was 11 months old. So my mom didn't have the ability to love me as I deserved as a little child, right? But I don't know that as a kid, right? Like, I don't know that mom is supposed to, like, nurture and care for, right? I don't know that dad is supposed to take care. I remember looking outside my bedroom window wondering if my dad was ever coming home, you know? And the car would come down the hill, and the car would make a left-hand turn instead of a right-hand turn into my apartment, my mom's apartment. And I remember as a little kid saying to myself, if I don't have a dad, then there is no God. You know what I mean? Like, I would go to church with my grandma. She was a Jesus-loving fanatic. She loved Jesus, and she made sure we loved Jesus. You know what I mean? And she would take me to church, and grandma would she'd do the things, you know what I mean? And I was, like, embarrassed. I'm like, grandma, people are going to see us, you know? And she'd want to dance, you know? And I was like, and what grandma got, right, I didn't get, right? Something inside of me was broken. Something inside of me was disconnected. I've learned what that is now, right, which we're going to get into. But I didn't understand that as a kid, right? Like, I thought that there was something wrong with me, right? It seemed that everybody else in the world, right, like, was connected. Everybody else in the world seemed to have it going on, right? And I always felt like I was on the outside looking in, you know? I've come to learn since I've been sober, right? I had a friend of mine, she heard my story. I went to high school there. She was like, you were the most popular kid in school, right? But my perception to life is just skewed, right? It's skewed just like that little bit, you know? And that little bit, man, I walk in and I'm like, before I had a solution, if you would have told me that it's not what I thought it was, it's only going to be this, I'd have been like, they hate me. You're a loser. You're finally found out, you know what I mean? And but like as a little kid, like I'm like an only child. I'm a bedwetter, you know. Any other bedwetters here? Oh, yeah. Right. Thanks, guys. Good looking out. You know what I mean? Fam bam right there. You know what I'm saying? But we weren't in elementary school going bedwetter, you know. And right, but there's a lot of shame attached to bedwetting, you know. I'd get like one sleepover invite, you know what I mean? Your friends are like, mom would be like, just go, you know? And I'm like, I don't want, I'm terrified. I'm scared. I don't want to do the sleepover. And mom would encourage me to go, you know? And I'd do the sleepover and I'd wake up in the morning and I peed my friend's couch, you know what I'm saying? And I'm full of shame and I'm terrified, right? That I'm, you know, I'm just inside, just crawling inside, and you know, and I'd flip the cushion over and hope they don't catch me, you know? And I never got invited over for another sleepover, you know what I mean? And, right? But like the disconnect for me is deep, you know? It's deep for me. I didn't know that I had this malady, right? This disconnection between me and you. I didn't know I had this disconnection between me and God. And more importantly, I didn't understand that there was a disconnection between me and me. Right? I remember as a little kid, long before I ever drank, as a little kid, I had this voice that said, you're a loser, you're a failure, and you're no good. Right? Long before I ever took my first drink, you know? I didn't know what alcoholism was, though I grew up in AA. Right? I was like the poster boy, which I'll get into my talk tonight. I won't talk about it too much. I really want to talk about my relationship with God, because I didn't believe in God until I was 10 years sober. And you can't walk around Alcoholics Anonymous saying you don't believe in God. Right? Imagine that conversation. Right? You'll be pigeonholed. You know, you have like 5 or 6 old timers. No, you don't believe in God, you know. I would say most days today I'm agnostic. And but I have a deep and profound relationship with this power. And, you know, I, What happened for me was I finally found alcohol. I'll talk about more about that tonight. But what happened for me was that alcohol connected me to you. Alcohol connected me to the world. Alcohol made it okay for me on the inside, you know. And so by fast forward, when I got sober, October 23rd, 2002. I have 19 years. I didn't plan sober, you know, staying sober 19 minutes, really. You know what I mean? And, you know, I look around the room and I think, geez, I'm like the youngest guy sober here probably by 30 years, you know? And what do I have to say, right, that somebody else doesn't already have? And I'm a true believer that when I say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous, right, God has me in the right place. An old timer by the name of John Ackerland, he told me when I was brand new, he said, you just show up to Alcoholics Anonymous and you say yes. I said, why do I have to say yes, John? He said, because that's where God wants you to be. And God wants me here for some reason, though. My mind says that you're not supposed to be the one. There's more qualified people that can be here. I have a separator. Main problem, the alcoholic center's in the mind, right? And it separates me from you. It's telling me I'm not good enough. It's telling me that smile is fake. It's telling me all of these things inside my head that fast. And it wants me out there so that I can get loaded, right? So that it can say that little thing that says it's all right for you to get loaded, you know? And I know today that it's the first drink that gets me drunk. I remember the old guys used to tell me it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And I thought, man, you need to drink through that, old man, you know? But I didn't know, right? I didn't understand. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous on October 23rd, 2002, a full-blown drug addict, right? I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for years. And they would point to me, any newcomers, and I'd sit way back there where Resin is, you know, my new boy Resin. And I would raise my hand, right? Because I'm dying of a disease that I don't know that I'm dying from. I have alcoholism, though I don't know what alcoholism is. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I sit back there and they say, are there any newcomers here? And I raise my hand and I know that drugs are a problem in my life. So I say, my name is Pat and I'm an addict. Not an AA, maybe an O curse, you guys are cool with that. But where I went to AA, man, every old guy turned around. They're like, there's an addict in our room. Let's get him out of here. You know what I mean? And fucking they all, you guys would be like, there's another meeting. Meet Bob. He'll send you to Narcotics Anonymous, you know? And I flip you off, you know what I mean? And I leave AA and I slam the door because I want you guys to know how mad I am. And no one ever followed me out, gave me a big book and said, take this to your bush or wherever you're living, you know? And maybe you might identify with what's in this book. And I go out there and I die. I come back to Alcoholics Anonymous and I would sit in your meetings, right, because it was safe. And there was more people concerned about the singleness of purpose around here than trying to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I come in here and I wouldn't identify. And then I would come here and say, my name is Pat, I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Put $2 in the basket, some are sicker than others, you know. And y'all made jokes, right? The old guys made jokes about the alcoholic and a. And I leave Alcoholics Anonymous, dying of a disease, not knowing what I'm dying from. And how do we expect the newcomer to know what alcoholism is? And I leave based on what I perceive your judgment of me, right? And I leave Alcoholics Anonymous, and no one ever said, hi, my name is Bob, want to go get some pie, I'll tell you my story, you know? And I go out there and I die. And I came I came to one morning, sexually assaulted for the first time in a bathtub. I had blood come every hole in my body. And I looked around the bed. There was no clothes. There was no towel. I went down the hallway of shame into the living room. I was just like trying to cover myself. There was three guys on a couch. And I looked in the corner and there was some clothes that looked like they were mine, and I put them on and I went outside, and there was a liquor store sign across the street. It was just like liquor. It was the brightest sign I've ever seen. It was 2:00 in the afternoon. It was a bright sign. It said liquor. And I knew that if I got into that store and could get that pint of tequila, everything would be all right. And I reached my hand in my pockets to see if I had any money, and I pulled out this number, right? And it was this guy's number from AA. And I had enough change for a phone call. Coincidence? Nah. But my mind said, coincidence. You know what I mean? And I put the change in there and I called this guy and I said, I need help. And he said to me, he said, can you wait 20 minutes to not drink? I said, I'm going in this liquor store to drink. And he said, can you wait 20 minutes to not drink? And I made that promise one more time. I remember making the promise to my mom over and over and over, meaning the promise. I meant the promise every time. And I made that promise. I said, I promise I'm not going to drink. Can you hurry up? And I walked in that liquor store and I got a pint of tequila and I was drunk just like that. And I blacked out and I came to on the North Shore. I was in Hawaii and I came to on the North Shore of Hawaii at an AA campout. And I didn't know it was an AA campout, but I do now, right, because I can look back. But it was the countdown of their campout. And I was the newest newcomer, and I was shaking the hand of this guy with 40-something years sober, and he was handing me the big book. And I wanted to punch that old guy, and I want to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. This little old lady named Myrtle came up to me, and she said, hi, son. She says, my name's Myrtle. She said, why don't you come with me? And I'll never forget the kindness of that woman. She didn't care if I was a drug addict, if I was on the streets, if I was an alcoholic. She said, come with me. And she took me over to where they were cooking food, and she said, well, we're gonna pick up trash. And she gave me a trash bag, and she grabbed a trash bag, and we walked around, and she picked up trash, and she said, you just do what I do. And she put trash in her bag, and I put trash in my bag. And for the next 30 minutes, we picked up trash. And we sat on this little stoop off to the side, and Myrtle looked at me, and she said, how do you feel, kid? And for the first time in a really, really long time, probably my whole life since I first started drinking, I hadn't thought about drinking and I hadn't thought about killing myself. And if service was enough to keep me sober, I'd have never drank again. And that guy took me back to that liquor store and he dropped me back off where he picked me up, and I walked in that liquor store and I drank just like that. And see, alcohol was dominating and alcohol was ruling my life. It didn't matter the situations, the consequences. And it took me another year and a half till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll talk about Al-Anon in my talk tonight, because Al-Anon saved my life. I hated y'all then, but I love you now, you know. And but what happened was I came to, and on the 23rd of October, and I called my mom, and I'll tell you later, but what happened was these guys from AA came. And they sat down and they read word for word out of this book. They talked about this physical allergy that when they put alcohol into their body, the places that they went. And where they went was the hospital. I didn't go to the hospital. So instantly, I'm looking for what we call the differences. I don't believe in that line, right? Because I'm looking at my story. Though I'm arguing with these guys in my head, right? They drink, they go to the hospital. I'm like, I go to jail. They drink, they go to the hospital. I go to jail. They drink, I go to jail, right? And he knew that I wasn't relating to his story. He knew. He could see it in me. He could see me walking out the door. And he ended up at this detox, and he got this guy named Pete. He goes, Pete, come on over. And Pete waddled on. Pete was like tattooed from head to toe. And Jack goes, when you drink, what happens to you, Pete? And Pete goes, I go to prison. Dude, and I was like, I go to jail. And Pete told me another story about drinking out of prison and going to jail. And I started talking about drinking and going to jail. And Pete drank and went to jail. And Pete goes, hey, John, come on over. Meet this goofy guy, Pat, you know. John came over. You know, next thing you know, there was like six or seven of us, right? And we're drinking and we're going to jail. High five. Oh, yeah, we go to jail. We're laughing. We're high-fiving, right? What's happening is I'm connecting for the first time in my life. For the first time in my life, I'm connecting to another human being, right? In the book, it talks about, right, the great peril. The great peril, right, is that I have alcoholism. You have alcoholism, right? The main, right here, between the ears. Check, 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 check. That guy Jack, this guy picked me up, man, he squeezed on that table. He got right between us, and he goes, Pat. I go, yeah. He's like, when you drink, you go to jail? I go, yeah. He goes, are you drinking while you're in jail? And I'm like, well, no, until I can find the Pruno, then I'm drinking, right? He goes, but you're sober in jail most of the time. I go, yeah, I'm sober in jail most of the time. He goes, then what's going on in jail? I go, well, I don't know. My mom comes and sees me, my good AA mom. She's 20, whatever year sober, right? And she would come see me, and I'd be sitting there in the glass. And my mom would be like, Patrick, what are you going to do different, you know? And I'm like, I'm going to AA when I get out. Going to AA, I'm going to get my life together, and I mean it. I make a promise to my mom, and I mean the promise. And then H and I would come, and I'd go sit with you, and you'd give me hope. And the hope that you would give me, right, was that if I got out of AA, I could sit with you. And I'd go to church, and I'd give my life over to Jesus, thinking that was the solution. And I meant every action that I took while I was in jail. But what I didn't understand was this thinking part of alcoholism, this second fold of alcoholism, right, which is this mental part. And the mental part for me, and I'm talking to Jack, right, because he started to talk about his thinking that led him back when he got out of the hospital. And I was like, Jack, he's like, I don't know, man, but every time like I get called out to leave, right, I'm in the holding tank, and I instantly think that, you know what, this drug is your problem, alcohol is not your problem. And so I get out of jail, and I drink, and before you know it, I'm back doing the drugs. Before you know it, I'm back in jail. He said, what happened that time? My mom comes and make the promise, H and I, church, the whole deal, right? And I started to tell him story after story after story after story after story after story. And he looked at me and he said, kid, he said, if you can concede both propositions, physical, that when you put alcohol into your body, you can't stop until you end up in this jail. Or more importantly, when you're in jail, you have a mind that's driving you back to the thing that's going to kill you. He said, you might be alcoholic. And he kept it silent like that, and I just started to cry. For the first time in my life, I knew what was wrong with me. I looked at Jack, I said, Jack, I'm alcoholic. He lit up like a chandelier, and he was like, I got a new guy, you know what I mean? He was a big book toting guy, you know what I mean? He was on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. He was service junkie kind of guy, you know, he had a year sober, man, and dude, we were just in it, you know what I mean? He was like, do the steps or die, you know what I mean? I was like, whoa, bro, you're going a little too fast, you know? And he looked at me, and he said, do you believe in God? And I was, absolutely not. Absolutely not, man. I'm not selling your little blue book on the corner. I'm not doing the bobbleheads, you know what I mean? I'm not doing it, man. But what I came to believe, because I sat in Alcoholics Anonymous, I believed your story. I believed your stories. You guys talked about just the horror and the madness, you know what I mean? And I believed your story. I believed that, well, you gave me hope is what I believed in. I believed in the hope that you delivered from this podium. And your hope in my mind, in my spirit, wherever it was, man, I said, man, if I can do what these guys do, I too can have a good life. And so I came to believe in you, and I made a decision to do what you told me to do, right? The decision was really simple. Do what these guys tell me to do. Okay, boom. Day one, right? Inventory in that place, right? Did my inventory, made all the amends I can make. I'm going to talk about all that tonight because I really want to talk about God. Because I didn't believe in God until I was 10 years sober, right? So how do you do a second step with a guy if you don't believe in God? I did it all the time. I read We Agnostics, right? Dudes were staying sober with a God having a better life than me. They made a decision. They found it. And I would argue and I would argue and I would argue your God all the time. And I would sit in the rooms and I got busy in service. Man, there's a lot of service to have here, right? There's a lot of things. It's been Orange County. I was like, I had a commitment at every meeting. I was on every convention committee. There's tons of them. I was busy guy. I was busy AA. You could depend on Pato. People would call, and I would get that sense of purpose, right, on what you guys thought of me in Alcoholics Anonymous, right, because I came to believe in you. And I had told my fifth step to my sponsor. I'll share my secret tonight, but I told my secret at that time to my sponsor, and his face was like, you know what I mean? I was like, no, don't go any farther, because there was more to it. And a year sober, I got this other guy he sponsored came up to me and he goes, yeah, I heard you have experience doing what my secret was. And one more time, another man had broken my trust. And I went from a year sober to 8 years sober. I had a sponsor, because you don't want to have that conversation too. You don't want to have the conversation, I don't believe in God and I don't have a sponsor in AA, you know what I'm saying? I had gone through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with that first sponsor, and I was taking guys through the book. Thank God for sponsorship, because the guys I sponsor saved my life. They eventually went on to someone more spiritual than me, you know what I mean? But and so here's the deal. For 8 years, not having a sponsor, holding on to my deepest, darkest secret, you can only imagine, right, the behavior that this character was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wanted a relationship so bad and didn't know how to have a relationship. I hadn't established a relationship with God. How could I have a relationship with you? How could I have a relationship with self? But I don't know that. And I get in, I get in a relationship with a girl, and what happened in Vegas didn't stay in Vegas because she got pregnant, and now I'm going to be a dad. And I don't have a dad in order to be a dad. I don't have a sponsor that's going to show me. Well, I have a sponsor, but I'm not using him, so I don't have the mentorship that's going to show me. And I'm absolutely terrified. And so I cheated on that woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd go home at night and want to put a bullet in my mouth and thinking that there's something wrong with me. And they're both in my home group on Wednesday night. The girl I cheated on her was her best friend. My son is born, and I look right into the eyes of God. And I know it, but I instantly, the wall came back up, because I'm terrified of connection with you. Terrified of connection with anything. And I'm running, and I'm running, and I'm running. And she found out. I had to sit in the home group with both of them. My sponsor's like, you're not going to F your way out of AA too. And I had to sit there, man. I had to sit there every week with both of them. And I'm a knucklehead. And so I did it again, and I did it again, and I did it again, and I did it again. We hear all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't judge around here. That's BS, man. Y'all judge me, and you had every right to. And I go home every night, and I want to kill myself. But I have this little boy. And I don't want to leave him without a father like my father had left me. I remember one night going to my son's crib, and I got down on my knees and I held his hands, and I didn't know I was saying a prayer. I thought I was saying goodbye to my kid, and I said, his name's Eden. His name's Eden Gannon Ochoa, for if you like acronyms. And stands for ego, if you're trying to figure it out, you know. Only an alcoholic would do that to their kid, you know. But I got on my knees and I held my son's hand and I told him how much I loved him. And I said, I need help. And I said goodbye to that little boy, and I got across the street to Target, and my phone started dialing my friend's number. I didn't touch the phone. And Bluetooth all of a sudden is ringing, my friend, and I'm going to kill myself. And he came down and he met me. And one more time, human dependency kept me alive. And this would continue on. At 8 years sober, I'm driving my car 100 miles an hour down the road, going to kill myself. And I was at the Nooner that day, you know what I'm saying? And I heard this lady, she said, well, you're right where you're supposed to be, you know. Or that line we say around here, nothing happens in God's world by mistake. And I don't understand what is wrong. I'm doing everything in Alcoholics Anonymous that you guys talk about doing. Service, sponsorship, all that kind of stuff. doing everything, busy. And I had this intuitive thought as I'm about to barrel my car onto oncoming traffic, right? I'm like about to turn my car. I'm at 98 miles an hour. The decision was at 100. And I heard a guy in the back seat of that car, or a voice in the back seat of that car, that said, call that guy Jonathan from your Tuesday night meeting before you kill yourself. And I picked up the phone. I was crying. And I said, Jonathan, I said, I'm going to kill myself. He said, what's going on? And I told him what was going on. I said, one more relationship broke because I cheated on another woman. And he said, Pat, I've been waiting for this call for a year. He said, I want you to meet me at Denny's. Will you meet me at Denny's? And I said, I'll be there. I'll show up. I'll be there. And he said, no, I'm going to stay on the phone till you get there. Because he knew I wasn't going to show up. And I drove into that Denny's and he opened the book to page 52 where it talks about these bedevilments. And he sat down and he said, we were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional nature. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. It was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight. Of course it was. And he looked at me and he said, I can bet that you have an insane sex life that you can add to that list. And he talked about having 17 years sober and wanting to put a bullet in his mouth. And he reached out to a man by the name of Luther Wood, who was sober a long time, and he reached out to a man by the name of Clint Hodges, who was sober a long time, who wanted to kill himself, who reached out to a man by the name of Don Pritz. And he talked about these men with long-term sobriety wanting to kill themselves in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never heard that before. I didn't understand there was people that struggled in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because we get up here and we talk about how great life is and we go home and we're depressed. We come up here and we talk about how great life is, but we're yelling at the person on our committee. We talk about how great life is and we're restless, irritable, and discontent. And I thought that I was the only one struggling around here. And he said, I'm not going to take you on as a sponsee because I don't want your blood on my hands, was exactly what he said. He said, but I'll take you through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous if you're willing to do that. And I said, I was. And he opened the book, and we agnostics, where it talks about these prejudices. It says, we found as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and accept even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for us to fully define and comprehend that power, which was God. And I was placed in a dilemma in my life because I didn't believe in God. But I had come to believe in you, which meant that I came to believe in something . And he said, Pat, I'm going to give you a simple assignment. What I want you to do is I want you to write all the capitalized words in We Agnostics, and I want you to put them on a piece of paper, and I want you to leave a couple spaces in between. And I want you to say the set-aside prayer. God, I set aside everything I think I know about life, everything I think I know about you, God, everything I think I know about the program, everything I think I know about these steps, and I ask that I have a new experience of this process. And he said, I want you to write down what that word means to you. And I wrote them all out, right? Power, God, spirit of the universe, creative intelligence, guiding. Right? Guiding for me, right, is this intuition inside that's guided me my whole life. Right? This power that's within inside of myself, right? When I walk into the room, right, and there's a connection between me and you, right, I experience the power of God. And what happened for me was through this assignment, I came to believe that God was love. I came to believe that God was intuition. I came to believe that it was within. And that I no longer had to search outside of self, right? Because every time I searched outside of self, I could never get to that place. And when I sat within the silence, I could feel God. And God asked me, Jonathan asked me, he said, kid, he's like, when you're sitting there in that silence, where do you feel God? I said, Jonathan, I feel God in my heart. He said, I want you to write a vision of sanity. I want you to look at the insanity as those bedevilments in your life. I want you to write a vision of sanity as if you were living within that power, which was God. Having trouble with personal relationships, that I'm absolutely okay with you. That I'm absolutely okay with God. That I'm prey to misery and depression. That sitting in the sanity for me is that I'm okay feeling the good and the bad. I'm okay with that internal feeling of knowing that God is here with me today. That I no longer have to act out within that anger. I no longer have to act out in that fear, right? That I'm okay with being just there. And I remember reading this to him, and he looked at me, and he wrote these things down, right? And he said, Pat, what are the things that are blocking you from God? Fear, Pat, money, right? These simple things. But the thing that was on there that I wrote on this list, right, was seven things. And the thing that was on there was what I came to believe in the beginning that God, that was what you guys in Alcoholics Anonymous thought about me. I ran around Alcoholics Anonymous being a service, right? And you guys would be able to depend on me. You'd be able to care about me. Pat can do it. Right? Let's call Pat. He'll do it. I was running around the country speaking all over the place, man. And what you guys, the accolades you gave me was what God was for me. And I wrote this thing down on the paper, right? And what people in Alcoholics Anonymous thought about me. And he said, great. He's like, this is a great list. You have seven things. I want you to write number eight, and I want you to write God on that list. I said, okay, what does this have to do with anything? He said, I want you to say a prayer. God, please take away these things on this list that stand in the way of having a relationship with you. And I read the prayer, I go, God, please take away these things that stand in the way of me having a better relationship with you. And I put the thing down and I go to sleep, or at least I try to sleep. I was suicidal from the day I asked for help that day at 8 years sober until I was 10. I didn't sleep for 7 days at a time. I was 30 pounds underweight. I continued to show up to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did this work as if my life depended on it. And for 2.5 months, man, I argued with God. F you, God. F you. I can't. I can't. I can't. And at 3:30 in the morning, in the pain, I came to realize that holding on to this idea of what you guys thought of me was no longer more important than my relationship with God. And I woke up in the morning and I had everything on that list crossed out. And number eight said, God. I called my sponsor. I was like, man, I'm willing. He said, this is great, Pat. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about in the last analysis, that's where God is found. And in that searching within myself, right, searching of having a relationship with God, man, I broke away the things that separated me from God. And he said, Pat, now you're willing to make a decision. He said, what is that decision for you? I pulled up the definition. I said, I don't really know what a decision means. He said, a conclusion or a resolution reached after consideration. Do you want to continue on with this insanity you're living? Or do you want to live a spiritual life? I made a decision with that man that I was going to do everything in my power to get closer to God. Today, my life centers around my relationship with God. My relationship, my prayer is constant with God on a daily basis. I am constantly within prayer. I'm constantly within breathing. I'm constantly with getting okay with you. So that when change occurs in my life, right, I don't have to react. I can be okay with what is. Absolute miracle. But I didn't get there by that decision. Just because I made the decision didn't mean that I was, oh. All I did was make a decision. And he said, this is great. Here's an inventory process. Here, start writing, right? And I started to write these resentments, and I wrote the resentment. My dad was not there for me. And then he goes, okay, second sheet, my dad wasn't there to play baseball with me. Third sheet, my dad didn't teach me how to fish. Fourth sheet, right? And I did the whole resentment inventory with everybody, but I'm only going to talk about my dad. He said, great, third column. Where did it affect? Did it affect your self-esteem, your security, your ambitions, personal relationships? Well, yeah, the first time I did, I just checked it. Oh, yeah, self-esteem, ambition, yes, personal relationships. He goes, what I want you to do is I want you to write these sentences. Self-esteem starts with, I am fill in the blank. So my dad didn't show up for me when I played baseball. I am not good enough to be loved. didn't teach me how to fish. I am not worthy of relationship. I am not good enough. And I started to see that these voices in my head and how they related to these relationships. Security. I need love to be okay. No wonder why I was chasing around cheating on all these people, right? That's a little side note, right? I need companionship to be okay. Whatever, I start writing these things. Personal relationships. My friend should. Right? I was the victim. My friend should have my back always. Women should understand that I don't have a dad. Sex relations. Right? And I started to write all this down. He said, write an inventory, fear inventory. I wrote all my fears, right? Worst case scenario. Fear of what you think of me. For worst case scenario, I walk in here, you guys all stand up, you throw tomatoes at me. Yeah, you effing loser. We don't care about your stupid workshop. Optimal with God. I'm absolutely okay with what the outcome is today. And so I had to write the worst case and the optimal. He said, write the sex inventory. I wrote the sex inventory. He said, I don't care about all the hookups. I don't care. I want to know about the relationships that was sexual tension. How did you respond when you got what you wanted? And how did you respond when you didn't get what you wanted? And I wrote these things out. And I sat down with them and I wrote this. I did my fifth step. We spent 8 hours doing this thing. Right? When someone said today 30 minutes, I was like, I wish it would have been 30 minutes. Yeah. Grueling. And he was writing things down. And I got done with this inventory. At the tail end, he was golfing, like in his room practicing. And I'm thinking, this is some serious stuff, you know. And I told him my deep, dark secret, which I'll share tonight. But what happened was he handed me this list of old ideas that came from my resentment inventory. I'll give you one about that I am not worthy of love. That I am not good enough or equal to be accepted by you. Had the composite sex paragraph from that question, what should I have done instead? I've had that intuitive thought my whole life. I knew exactly what to do in every relationship. He wrote this thing and he gave it to me, and we talked about six, and I wrote a list of new ideas. I took the old idea, and with God, I created this new idea that I was equal to. I was okay being. I didn't need validation. I was already loved. I got on my knees and I said, my creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, the good and the bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defective character which stands in the way of me having a better relationship with you. I no longer had to judge if it was an asset or a liability. I was giving all of myself to God, the good and the bad. And that I asked God to take away the things that separated me from you. To take away the things, right, that to leave me with what I needed to be of service to you. And remember, I'm suicidal in this time. And I would call my sponsor, and I made all the amends. I sat down with every female except one. She didn't want nothing to do with me. And I made this amends, and I sit down and I say, I'm here to make amends. And I list the harms that I had caused. And then I said, is there anything I've done that I'm unaware of? And I had to just sit and listen. And this girl looked at me and she said to me, she said, I value that you've come to me and you've expressed the harm you've caused to me. She said, but the harm that you caused to me impacts every relationship I've been in since I've been with you. Because I haven't trusted another man since I've been with you. And I got real present to the harm that it caused a human being plus the ripple effect. And I said, can you please tell me how this made you feel? And I had to just sit and listen. It was brutal. But the impact, right, of the harm that I caused, the emotional impact that I could feel started to change the inside. The character defect started to change on the inside by taking the action and being present to the pain and really getting present to what was happening. I don't work on my character defects. It's like the needle never moves. I think that I want this character defect, but I'll tell you what, the character defect that has not been removed allows me to help you. Sponsee after sponsee after sponsee that comes to me, right, is I'm able to help. And I call my sponsor on the bridge and I go, I'm going to jump off. I can't do this anymore. And he would say, how's it amends to your dad coming along? And I said, I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to make it. And he said, kid, he said, I love you like a son. And I'd like to say goodbye to you before you kill yourself. You think you can meet me at the meeting tomorrow? Now, me and my sponsor and his wife and his kids would invite me and my son to dinner every Sunday through this whole process. And every Sunday night, I sat with a family for the first time. I didn't know what was going on. I sat with a husband and a wife, two kids, me as his kid, because I started, and his other kids. And I started to see what a healthy relationship looked like. And I made that, okay, I'll see you tomorrow at the meeting. I won't kill myself tonight. I'll see you tomorrow. And I would go to the meeting and he would kiss me on the forehead like he kissed his son, which was weird. You know, I was like, oh, yeah. And he says, I love you, son. He said, will you meet me at the meeting tomorrow? And I wouldn't remember. I was probably going to kill myself in an hour. And so I'd say, yeah, I'll meet you tomorrow. And I would call him 2 hours later, I'm going to kill myself. And he'd say, you promised me to meet me at the meeting tomorrow. I'd like to say goodbye to you before you kill yourself. He'd say, how's that amends to your dad coming? I said, I'm not going to make it. I don't know about how long it was before I finally caught on. Don't call the guys and tell you to meet him at the meeting. You know what I'm saying? But I finally pulled my car over on a bridge over the freeway, over the 5 freeway in Orange County. And I said, God, you have 10 seconds. Because I'm jumping off this bridge. For the first time in my life, I went from human dependence to a dependency on God. I got out of my car and I got to the headlight of the driver's headlight of my car and my phone rang. And I looked at my phone and it was an unknown number, which I don't answer unknown numbers. But I answered it that day. I had an intuitive thought that said to answer it. And I answered it and I said, hello, this is Pat. And this kid said, Pat, he's like, this is Chris. And I wanted to call and thank you because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you saved my life. He said, but I'm leaving Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm going to go get loaded. And I said, oh, no, Chris, we don't drink one day at a time here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was like, I can't do it. And he started telling me the thinking that he was in. And I started to talk about the thinking that precedes the first drink. And I had an intuitive thought that there was a meeting starting at 7:30 at the Canyon Club in Laguna. I looked at my phone. It was 7 o'clock, and I was 30 miles from that meeting. And I knew deep down within that God was in the middle of all this. And I said, Chris, I said, there's a meeting. You want to meet me there? He said, yeah, I'll meet you there. I said, because I'd like to say goodbye to you before you kill yourself, you know? And I got in my car and I drove 30 miles south. And I walked into the Candy Club that day and there was Chris. And Chris was crying and Chris gave me a big hug. And I gave Chris a big hug. And he said, thank you for saving my life. And then he asked me to be his sponsor. That old guy, John Ackerlin, told me to always say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said yes that day. And I said, yes, I'll be your sponsor. And I went home that night and I was arguing with God. And I'm having a conversation and a discussion and an argument. Like, I don't understand. I don't understand why you continue to put new people in my life to help. I said, I just want out. I just want to die. I can't feel this way anymore. And I felt a hand on my shoulder that pushed me off of the couch. It was 3 in the morning. It was, you know, and I just was screaming at God, I can't. Excruciating pain, out the words came, an amends to a man I never met. I don't have a part in that relationship. My mom got pregnant in a blackout. But where had I been selfish and self-seeking in every area of my life? The little boy in the baseball field that said, if I only had a dad, I'd know how to play baseball. If I only had a dad, I'd know how to be a boyfriend to you. If I only had a dad, I'd know how to be a friend to you. If I only had a dad, teach me how to live life, I would be all right. And I start making amends to a man I never met, man. And the victim was pulled out, and the power of God, which was love, went deep down within. And I got off the floor, and I went into my bedroom that day, and I fell asleep just like that. It was the last amends I had to make. I made amends to God. I made amends to my dad. And in that moment, I was free. And I'm a firm believer in the promise of the 10th step that says we have entered the world of the Spirit. Profound. I can tell you that I haven't had to act out in that behavior since I was 8 years sober when I made that phone call that day. My mom gave me ancestry DNA. Well, let me back up. I was speaking in Portland, or I know in Medford, Oregon, or somewhere, right? And I had found out some information about my dad. And I was going to confront my mom. I'm pissed. My mom knew who it was, all this, right? And I was there, and I sat down with another guy. I said, can I borrow your time? He had 37 years. And I said, hey, this is what's going on. I'm going to confront my mom. He said, this really sounds like it's about you. How is that going to benefit this situation? I said, well, it's not, but I'm at least going to know. And he just said, I would strongly suggest that you don't do that. And I respected this guy, and I didn't do that. And about a year before my mom passed away, she gave me ancestry DNA. And this is years after I made this amends, right? I didn't know that entering the world of the Spirit, I opened my spirit to new experiences in life. I didn't know that I opened myself up to possibility. I didn't understand that I had entered the world of the spiritual world. I didn't know. I didn't know what even that meant. I do the ancestry DNA, and it comes back, and I have this expectation I'm going to meet my dad. But guess what? My dad wasn't on there. And I'm a temper tantrum kind of alcoholic, so I threw it down. Well, there was a first cousin on there. I didn't even know what a first cousin was because I had an expectation. So I threw it down. About a year later, close right before my mom goes on hospice, right, what happens is I get a call, or I get a message, and then I call. And this lady goes, yeah, you're my first cousin. And I said, yeah, my mom got pregnant in a blackout. I'm never going to know, you know. She said, I'm going to help you find your dad. And so then I get another message from someone else because they had just taken ancestry DNA and they were a first cousin. They lived in San Diego. The other one lived in Northern California. And so I was like, okay. And my mom got pregnant in a blackout, blah, blah, blah. She says that the second person goes, I think that you are my uncle. I'm like, what? I'm like, how do you think that? Like, that's just weird. Like, I didn't say that, but I'm thinking it, right? And I go, okay. She goes, yeah, and you have 6 brothers and sisters that live in San Diego. And I'm like, what? She tells me her last name. The last name's Sandoval, right? And so I'm like, okay, you know. And now my mom goes to the hospital. My mom's on hospice, which I'll talk about later. But I go in, I sit in the hospice, and I go, Mom, I go, man, this lady told me that I have 6 brothers and sisters that live in San Diego. And she's like, really? I go, yeah. She goes, what's the last name? I said, the last name is Sandoval. And my mom this fast goes, your dad's name is Sandy Sandoval. He was the owner of the bar I used to drink in. I call the lady. I go, dude, Sandy? She goes, yep, that's your dad. Exactly what I believe to know is true. Has 6 brothers and sisters that live in 60 miles from me. I have aunts and uncles that live in Northern California. I went from a mom and an only child, right? My mom dies with huge, like 7 aunts and uncles that live in Northern California, cousins that are like just hundreds and hundreds and right, just down the line. And I have 6 brothers and sisters that live in San Diego, right? And I go, and when my mom died, I remember looking, I was like, I'm an effing orphan. Not the truth. COVID happened. I couldn't go see him. We had a reunion plan, COVID. But I snuck up to Northern California to meet the ones that were willing, you know. Last 4th of July, I sat down with 6 brothers and sisters. And I'll tell you what, it was like we met, like we were born together. I felt a connection instantly. I felt that connection instantly because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything in my life that I have good in my life should have a stamp of it. AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, circle and triangle, something stamped on it. Because I didn't want to do what you guys told me to do. I didn't want to make that stupid amends to my dad. I didn't want to show up. I didn't want to do this, right? But in spite of me, strong sponsorship and your encouragement in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I took those actions. I got to experience that. Right. 10th step. What's about 10th step? I got a 15-year-old kid. He lives with me half time. He lives with his mom half time. And his mom has no boundaries, and I'm structured, right? And so I know that about an hour in, I give him about an hour transition because he's a little prick for an hour, you know what I mean? Because he gets over on his mom, right? He respects and loves me. So I give him an hour, but sometimes I'm not so spiritual, or we'll just say patient. So he came. He was at my house, and he started giving me attitude. And I said, you effing little punk. I said, I'll take you outside and beat your effing butt. And I felt it on the inside. My 15-year-old boy was terrified. I reacted from that place of fear. I pulled myself aside and I said, God, I don't want to treat my son like this. Please help me. And I heard deep down within, you owe that boy an amends. And I called my sponsor and he didn't answer. I left him a message. I said, I just told my son, blah, 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 blah. And I talked to God and I'm going to make amends to my son. Talks about it. When fear, resentment crop up, immediately we pray. We ask God to remove the fear. Call someone, make amends immediately, and then turn my thoughts and attentions to who I can help. It's right there, 10th step. Immediately. So I go, hey, son, I go, you want to go on a walk? I need to make amends. He looks at me, he's like, not really. He said, but I will, Dad. We went on a walk, and I said, I don't even know how to make this. I don't even know how to start this conversation. He goes, I don't either. And I made amends to him. I said, I reacted from a place of fear. And when I started to give my mom attitude when I was your age, I dropped out of school. I started drinking. I started smoking weed. I started doing drugs, right? I ended up in juvenile hall. And I'm terrified that when I see your attitude, that's where you're going to go. He looked at me and he said, Dad, I'm not like you. He said, I have a mother and a father in my life who love me. He goes, I'm an honor student. I'm a straight A student in high school. We're not alike. I was like, that big. And I said, son, I said, what can I do to make this right? And he looked at me and he said, never treat me like that again. He's like, I've never been scared of you my whole life. And I was, for the first time in my life, I was scared of you. I was given my marching orders. I'm a 15-year-old boy. I know exactly how to treat that guy, that little man, you know. He's a young man, you know. But what happened for me in his relationship was it started to become closer union. I sat down with my son for breakfast before we came here. Man, we had a little, you know, he's able to turn it, you know, turn around. I'm able to turn around, and we have a partnership, you know. The 11th step, man, I'll tell you this. When COVID happened, man, I was terrified, you know what I'm saying? I got on my knees. I was spiritual giant. You know what I mean? I was like, woo, spiritual guy. All of a sudden, the news is like, we're going on a lockdown. You know what I mean? Spirituality right out the window. You know what I'm saying? I was terrified. I went shopping. Dude, I shopped for like 3 months. I was looking for the toilet paper. Y'all stole it, you know? And, dude, I was flipping out. You know what I mean? I'm like, we're going to be locked down forever. We're going to, you know. Rah, rah, rah. If I back up a little bit, I've always had a problem with meditation. I'm a thinker. I'm always thinking. Got to have the right yoga pants. I don't wear them, but you know what I mean? I got to have the right outfit. Got to have the right meditation room. I got to have the right crystals. They're not aligned right. I got to line them. Got to have the right incense. I like yours more than mine. Where'd you get it? Takes me a month to get it, right? You see what's happening, right? And so I had a friend of mine, Eric. He goes, Pat, he's like, do you do meditation? I'm like, nah, I'm thinking all the time. I can't really think. He goes, I think too. I go, well, how do you meditate and think? He goes, I breathe in, exhale. Breathe in, exhale. Focus on breath. He goes, then when a thought comes, I go, discontinue thought, refocus on breath. Breath in, breath out, thought comes. I go, you think what? He goes, yeah. He goes, I give you 5 minutes permission to be late to anything you do. Oh, you're going to give an alcoholic permission? Sign me up. He goes, but I want you to meditate in that 5 minutes. And so I did that. I practiced that for 2.5 years. Every day. Every day. Every day. I didn't see the benefits of it. And then COVID happened. And all of a sudden, I was fearful for about 2 weeks or however long it was. But all of a sudden, I had this thought that said, discontinue thought, focus on breath. So I dropped into meditation. I was meditating. Breathe in, breathe out. Thought, oh my God, we're going to die. Okay, focus on breath. Oh my God, we're going to die. Focus on breath. You know what I mean? And all of a sudden, in meditation, I heard you could be of service to your folks in your group. There's a thing called Zoom we started to hear about. And you can figure that out for your group. And you can get the old timers plugged into Zoom. And so I got up, man, and I was like, oh, floating around, you know what I mean? We're going to get Zoom and we're going to do it all. And I'm happy guy. And, oh, I love, you know, all this art we're doing, you know. But I'm a human. This human it starts to have a spiritual experience. I got down on my, you know, and I start doing the meditation again. I'm terrified and I'm breathing in and I start to see in meditation that I had when I first got sober, my first job, I rose to the top. I was making 6 figures. I was fired. I didn't know how I was going to pay the bills. I saw in meditation how God provided everything I needed. I built a business with these partners. And if you build me, you know how that is. Partnership fell apart. They stole the company from me. I had an attorney that settled the case that stole the money the day my mom died. And in meditation, seeing this, I saw how God showed up over and over and over and over and over. And I saw that my relationship with God got deeper and deeper and deeper. I saw how the places I lived got better and the cars got better and the things in my life were more abundant through all of it. And I saw that God was building me up to the man at that moment. I saw that the process of the 12 steps brought me to a God of love, brought me to the light within. And in meditation, I realized that it was my responsibility to go out into the world and put a smile and put the light and put love in everybody's life in the darkness that we experienced. And I got off the floor that day and I walked outside with a mask on, don't judge me, and I went out into the world to bring love and light in your world. And I got through that whole situation. We buried more people. Well, I won't go, that's an opinion and I won't go there, but we buried a lot of people from a fentanyl overdose. I have a sponsee whose son was born without functioning kidneys. And in COVID, I did a 12-step call on a homeless kid in Orange. And me and my son went down there, and we were down there. And I called him, and I said, hey, we're right here. And he was at Chalk Hospital, where they do all this stuff with kids. And I came down. He had his kid with a mask on. And I was like, dude, like, why are you bringing your kid? Like, he's no kidneys. Aren't you afraid he's going to die? And he said to me, Pat, his whole life we've had to make, decisions. And those decisions, a lot of times we had to weigh out, like, the benefits. And it's beneficial for us to connect with you today that we're willing to walk through the situation. And I came to believe that my relationships with you were more important. Chris saved my life, that kid that saved my life on that bridge. He ended up overdosing and dying. But I stand here today, an absolute free man. Sponsorship's been the greatest gift. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, because of jail, I was prejudiced towards everybody. I hated you. I hated myself. I hated every race. I hated whites. I hated blacks. I hated everybody. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I hated black people. I hated them. The first kid that I spoke, the first time I spoke was at a meeting. I was 6 months old, 6 months sober, old too. And this kid came up to me in the greeting line, and he thanked me for talking, and he thanked me for telling his story. And that kid asked me to be his sponsor. And that kid was a black kid. And out the words came, I would love to be your sponsor. That kid changed my life. I had the experience of the 12 steps. I took him through the 12 steps. Talked about the principles that are laid out in this book. I applied the principles to my relationship with him. He took me to his family because he wanted to introduce me to his family. They brought me in and they fed me. I have a relationship with his mom today. He hasn't been able to stay sober, but I have a relationship with his mom today, and we talk back and forth about her son. I help her, right, to be able to apply principles in her life so that she doesn't continue to be broken by her son. I absolutely love him, and I love her family today. I'm going to end on one more sponsorship story. I don't know why this is coming up, but it's pretty heavy. It was at my, this guy was 3 years sober. He came to me two years sober and to kill himself. And we're at my meeting, and it was at my house, and it was, and meeting at 10:30. And he, it's time to do a third step, and he started crying. And I said, what's going on? He couldn't tell me. I said, what secret are you holding? And he started to talk about having sexual relationships with his 12-year-old daughter. And everything inside of me wanted to grab that guy by the throat and hurt him. As my 6-year-old son is in the room next door. And I said, God, please give me the words. Give me the love and give me the compassion that I need in this moment. And I looked at this man, and I gave him a hug, and I welcomed him to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I told him at that point that if he did Alcoholics Anonymous, he'd no longer have to live that way again. And I asked him if he was willing to go through the steps, and he was. But what happened for me, the longest journey I go from is from my head to my heart. Because all of my judgment, I was faced with my relationships with you. Time and time and time again, I hurt you, I hurt you, I hurt you, the behavior that I had caused. And it went from judgment to compassion. That man ended up turning himself in, as had been in prison for a long time. I have a relationship with that man today. I don't approve of the behavior, but I absolutely love the human being. He has a relationship with God. He's in that institution carrying the message. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is the single most important thing in my life, and I love you all. Thank you so much.